and welcome to the Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter, and just like Alan Partridge, they've given me a second series of this year's show. This is the show where we delve into the weird and strange world of sports commentary. I've been a football commentator on local and national radio for over 20 years, and everybody I meet in the press box has a different tale to tell about how they got to where they are and the journey that they've been on, which, as usual, as we've discovered over the episodes in the first series, there's a myriad of routes that people use. There's an archive of episodes where you found this one going all the way back to the first episode I did way back when with Ian Crocker and Guy Mowbray. And included in that, there's episodes with the likes of Barry Davis and my dear late friend Nigel Pearson, who was one of the first guests on the Commentator's Curse, who we sadly lost in the past year. So let's get on with today's particular episode. And I've got two guests, as usual, joining me. The first of which is a man who I've got to know over the years, who was a doyen of independent radio and was a real trailblazer for football commentary on independent radio, but made the transition to television. You'll know him very well as a regular commentator on Match of the Day and for the BBC at major tournaments. Jonathan Pearce is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Dance. How are you doing?
Very, very good, sir. Thank you for coming on. And my other guest is actually over the pond, because he's one of the most well-travelled commentators I think I've ever known and probably will ever know. He has worked, started in Scotland, his native Scotland, has worked in Germany, still works on German football, works in the States, works in the Premier League. It's hard to tie him down, but I've managed to tie him down for an hour. Derek Ray is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Dan. It's great to be with you. I'm with JP.
Now, listen, I must get your perspectives first of all, gents, because here we are recording this. I think we allowed ourselves to decompress a month after the festivities in Qatar for the World Cup. What were your reflections from your individual perspectives on the tournament we've just witnessed? I'll start with you, JP.
Love the football. It was very eventful. It was a new story in most of the games that I did. Be it, you know, the Argentina-Netherlands game or whatever, Brazil having that wonderful first 45 minutes against Korean Republic, all the way back to the first game I did, which was France against Australia, I think. And, you know, there was always something newsworthy in the football. I have to say, I didn't like the place. I had a lovely apartment that the BBC provided, nothing wrong with that, and I just didn't, it wasn't for me. It was dripping with wealth for a certain level of society, and because of where we were, I spoke to a lot of the immigrants over there, and their lives aren't happy. They can send money back to their respective countries from whence they came, but they have no money to go and see their family. So I was introduced to one who hadn't never seen his daughter, she's now 8, and another one who hasn't seen his family for another 8 years, he was from Nigeria. And it's just not for me, that way of life, and so I didn't like the place at all and the inequality of it.
No, well, I was fairly sheltered from that. We stayed in a hotel. So, as you say, because you were in an area where you were far more likely to run into people who got stories to tell, that is far more likely to inform your opinion of it. I it did seem a little, I don't know, that there was a veneer.
Yeah.
That I guess if you scratched the surface, you didn't have to scratch too hard, I guess, to get beneath that veneer. Derek, what about you?
It's really interesting listening to JP there. We didn't talk about this off air. So what he said would almost be my experience of Qatar as well. The football was great. The matches, I think, were surprisingly good, because I was a bit worried going in about what the quality would be like given the time of year. It was new territory for all of us, and it could have gone in any number of different directions. But the football was broadly quite good. I thought there was something missing in terms of the atmosphere. It was my 9th Men's World Cup altogether, and this one did feel distinctly different. There wasn't the same buzz that I remember, whether it was in Brazil, whether it was in South Africa, whether it was in Germany, my favourite, in 2006. And I had that same experience of talking to migrant workers, and I remember vividly one woman from the Philippines one night in a restaurant who had been working there for more than 3 years. And she told me she had 3 children back home in the Philippines, and they were being looked after by her mother permanently. And I said, could you go back and see them? She said, no, because of the way my contract is set up, I'm simply not allowed to do it at the moment. And that broke my heart. And it seemed to me that everywhere you went, there were people holding doors for you, you know, for no reason. I'm uncomfortable with that kind of pomp and ceremony. I'm not that kind of person. I don't like the idea of somebody serving me all the time. I don't think I'm that special. So, I would echo a lot of what JP has said. But, yeah, the football was great, and it's always a privilege to cover the World Cup.
It's interesting because we were in Russia 4 years before.
Yeah.
And, you know, both Derek and I go back a long, long way on these tournaments, and I've done nine men's as well, a couple of women's in that run. But in Russia, we were showing the Russia we were supposed to see. I had a well of a time in Russia. I loved it. And the Russian people I met were fantastic. The ordinary people were fantastic. But we were shown the Russia we were supposed to see. It still felt like a real World Cup, though. This one in Doha, it was like a World Cup in a theme park. It was in one city. In Russia, we travelled all over. I remember being in USA 94. The length and breadth of the United States of America, you'll see in Chicago 1 minute, Orlando. What a difference between those two cities, and San Francisco and New York. And look at this. I mean, Derek, the cities we went to in Brazil were so varied. The country was so vast. And that's all part of it. You have to see those different places to experience a genuine World Cup. And this was a World Cup in one city. And the football was fun. The football was fun. I think the other thing, we've yet to see the fallout from Doha 2022 in the domestic leagues. It's fragmented the season. Certain clubs have not really got going as they would have been expected to, because I think players would anticipating the World Cup. Then if they got their hearts broken, now the fallout's going to happen in the Premier League and around the world as well, around Europe. So Doha, I think, has got implications for football, not just in the domestic league, but Saudi are going to get a World Cup back in that part of the world. I don't think it'll be next time. I don't think it'll be the time after next, but it might be in 8-10 years' time. It'll go back there again. Yeah. So, you know, it's got implications, I think, that will long, long reverberate.
Don't worry, JP, some things don't change. Birmingham is still 17th and not going to get any higher or necessarily any lower. But I've set myself right up saying that. You're right about the fact one city and the theme park thing. I mentioned in a blog I wrote when I got back that I felt like I just had the FIFA logos burnt onto my retina, because that's just what you see everywhere you go, from training complex to stadium to media shuttle bus to IBC. But you're right, when I went to Brazil, the trip to Manaus alone was just an incredible adventure. I stayed in a hotel which had a zoo in its back garden. Yeah. It's just a ridiculous thing, bandicoots and gibbons and all sorts in a zoo at the back of the hotel, just completely random. Let's go back to beginnings, as I like to do on this podcast, and talk to you both about your ambitions as a youngster. John, JP, you're a Bristolian.
I'm Cornish, actually, but I was brought up in
Bristol. Yes, but that's very true. Yes, but as a boy, what was the was there an ambition to do something with regard to broadcast journalism, or did it fall into your lap? How did it all come about initially?
I wanted to play for Bristol City. That's all I wanted to do in life. Still do, I trained with them when I was a youngster. I broke my leg when I was 14, 15. I can't remember now, back in the distant mists of time. But I think I was 14, and they said I wouldn't be able to play football. I don't think I'd have made it then, so I wasn't quick enough. And I wasn't good enough, really, to make it. I don't think anyone did out of the group I was in, to be fair. I got goalkeeper, got taken on as an apprentice back in those days, but that was it. Now, what was also happening at that time, from 1972-73 onwards, my dad and the manager at the time, Alan Dix, and the assistant manager called Tony Collins, who was a brilliant football man, so was Alan, they come up with this idea of filming the matches for analytical purposes. We were the first club in Europe to do it. I think AD had gone across to the States, where it was more common, and come back with this idea. And my dad, who had been involved in cable television, it was part of his job, took this on board, and I'd known Alan Dixon, so we lived in the same road. I'd known him since I was a little boy. I worked with my dad. I was up on gantries when I was 12, 13. Imagine nowadays, kid going up on a gantry at 12, 13. You know, parents would get arrested. Anyway, so I carried on with this work with my dad. We filmed the games. Reel to reel it was. And each reel lasted about 25 minutes. So we had to change the reels. Inevitably miss game, miss goals sometimes. And we carried on doing that. And then... I worked with my dad once, so I realised I wasn't going to be a player and carried on going. And when I was at university, at Birmingham University, a job came up with Radio Bristol, and Alan Dix and Bristol City pushed Radio Bristol for me to get that job to such an extent that when I went for the audition, I had to commentate on VT there and then, blind. But of course, the VT was the VT that my dad and I had shot. So the night before I went to the audition, it was leaked to me from Alan Dix and my dad what games I was going to have to commentate on. So it was a cheat, and it fell into my lap, and each job has come along the way. Very, very lucky. I've been incredibly fortunate to do what I've done, and through Capital, Radio, BBC Radio Bristol, Radio West, GWR, Capital Gold, BBC, just so fortunate, so incredibly fortunate.
I will get to that route that you took to get you, you know, to the Capital Gold days and then on to working for Channel 5 and for the BBC. But Derek, on to you. We've had people on this podcast. Kevin Hatchard springs to mind in one of the early episodes who talked about taping himself, watching commentaries on television. There's a story that you actually used to go to actual live games with a tape recorder as a young boy to commentate on matches.
Yeah, and that would be true. It really, for me, goes back to 1974. I was seven at the time, and of course the World Cup was happening in West Germany, as it was. And we had just bought our very first recording device. Don't know if you remember these big old-fashioned stereo cassette recorders. Yeah. And we had one in the house for the first time, and I thought this was the most incredible toy. And during that World Cup, I would impersonate the commentators, and I still actually have a tape somewhere of my fledgling attempts at this at the age of seven. Anyway, from that point on, we bought a much smaller version of the same thing, and I would, you know, carry it around and commentate on games on an impromptu basis in the park or at school. And I sort of got a reputation for being this you know, silly young laddie, being a Scot, who would just talk to himself. And then I plucked up the courage to take the recording device with me to Pittodrie, the stadium in Aberdeen. I'm a very proud Aberdonian. My local team is Aberdeen. And I would do this initially at the reserve games and then did it for first team games beginning around the age of 12. And I would find a little seat at the front of the south stand where it was a bit quiet, where there weren't people right beside you. But I was aware that people were watching me and again, sort of asking the question, what's he doing? What's going on here? But I would keep these tapes. And my great hero at that time was a fellow who wasn't that well known in England, but was a real icon in Scotland in broadcasting, a guy called David Francie, mm-hmm. who was the radio voice of BBC Radio Scotland at that time, had a very distinctive delivery, you know, very, very much impersonated by everybody in Scotland. David Francie, you know, he had that sound that everybody knew at the time. And, you know, when you would play games on the playground at school, you would sort of do his voice to some of the goals because, you know, that's how famous he was at the time. So one day, out of the blue, I said, I'm going to send a letter to David Francie. I'm going to send him one of these tapes. I probably will never hear from him. He'll probably never get the tape, but, you know, what the heck. So I did it. And to my surprise, to my delight, 3 weeks later, I got this beautiful handwritten response from David Francie saying he'd listened and really liked what he heard. And maybe he was flattering me at that point. My voice hadn't even broken. But he sent back some lovely tips, which I still use to this day, some sort of vocal tips. And he said, you know, if you ever see me at a game, then say hello. So I did that. And we kind of kept in touch for a number of years. And this led to hospital radio for me. So, you know, like JP, we all sort of need a starting point, sometimes on an amateur basis, just to get experience. And I would commentate for the hospital radio station on the Aberdeen reserve games and first team games for a number of years in my teens. And then went to university. And it was at that point I decided to reconnect with Mr. Francie and sent him another tape. And hopefully by that time, I was 19, by that point, my work was a lot more professional sounding. And this tells you everything about people, in this case, about David Francie. Instead of just writing back to me, he actually gave it to his boss at the BBC. He said, have a listen to this. And I got a call from his boss at the BBC inviting me down to Glasgow, where the headquarters were and are, and was asked, would you like to do some reporting for us? So I did some reporting on an Aberdeen Celtic game. And then a couple of weeks later, David Francie himself had a knee injury and couldn't do a game. And they called me and said, would you like to fill in for David Francie on Kilmarnock against Dumbarton, 1986. That was my very first game as a professional on the air. We can maybe get into some of the other stories after that, but it was the starting point for me of professional broadcasting. And as JP said, we're all very blessed and very lucky if we can do this for a living. And I'm thankful that I've been able to do it as a professional from that point on.
I practiced when I was a kid. You know, you said that, did you have any ambitions to become? I didn't, but I just wanted to play. But when I was a kid, I used to commentate on Sabutio. And so I would play myself at Sabutio, and because I was always guaranteed to win. And I played the whole 1970 World Cup, every qualifying match all the way through. And I commentated on all of this, and I used to commentate into a little tape machine as well. But I'd play it back and then make jot down all the stats and all that sort of stuff. So I had all the stats for the Sabutio players, right? How many cautions they'd had and all this sort of stuff. And it was interesting because I used to play Sabutio on the living room floor and commentate. And then my parents moved the Sabutio table up into my bedroom and I used to commentate up there. And then they moved it up into the attic. And I never got a message, you know, for ages and ages and ages. But anyway, yeah, that final, Derek, England beat Scotland 7-6 in the final. I remember it to this day. And the reason Scotland got to the final is that and Eddie Gray scored two hat-tricks in the final for Scotland. He scored all six goals. I was a massive Eddie Gray fan. Yeah. Still am to this day. And you're a wonderful player. And all Bristol City players who had a massive influence on my life, Jerry Gow, Tom Ritchie, Jerry Sweeney, Donny Gillies, these were all Scots boys. So, I think I actually elevated one or two of them into the Scotland squad as the Sabutio carried on going until I was about 52. Anyway, but there you are. And then my first game was at Twerton Park for Radio Bristol. It was an FA Cup extra preliminary tie. And then I went on the Tuesday to Bristol Rovers against Exeter in the League Cup at the old Eastfield ground. And the sports editor was a man called David Solomons. And I went there to just do reports. And it got to extra time. And the agreement was, in those days, that you could commentate. You'll know these from when you were at the BBC. And when I knew Derek, first of all, from when we worked at the BBC together in London. Right. And anyway, so the agreement was if it goes to extra time, Dance, you could commentate for free. You didn't have to pay any extra money.
Right.
So it gets to extra time, and David Solomons passed me the microphone and said, commentate. And that was it. I had nothing prepared, and it went to penalties. I remember Tony Kello. I've still got the notepad here of all the penalties to take. Kello played for Exeter. I remember him playing there. Yeah, I've still got all that stuff. I don't throw things away. I'm a hawk.
So how old were you on that occasion? How old were you roughly?
78. It was my 20, I was.
Right.
So I've been doing it 42. This is 43 years.
Yeah. Wow. So both thrown in to the thick of it at the deep end. Actually, do you know what, Derek? One thing we haven't ever spoken about in any great detail on this podcast is the Scottish angle of football commentary, because a lot of people talk about their influences, and of course David Coleman has come up a lot, and Motti and Barry Davis, who I've been lucky enough to speak to. You mentioned David Francie there, and of course the Scottish voice we all knew down south, because you had Sports Scene whilst we had Match of the Day, was Archie McPherson. I don't know how big an influence Archie was.
Well, I got to work with Archie once I joined the BBC. And of course, he was a giant amongst broadcasters, amongst personalities in Scotland at that time. We actually had Archie and Arthur. People used to speak about Archie and Arthur all the time. Arthur Montford, who was the equivalent of Archie on STV, on commercial TV. And, you know, they did everything in those days. It was a bit like Brian Moore on ITV. Didn't just commentate, but he was the face of the broadcast as well. And Archie and Arthur would do that. You know, they would commentate on a game, and then you would see them also presenting the main program. And I think that would be the one difference. We didn't get to see Match of the Day as youngsters. It was not on in Scotland. So we had Sports Scene, which was on BBC, and it would, of course, be highlighted by a Scottish game. And then you would get the English highlights afterwards with either John Motson or Barry Davis, whatever the biggest English game was that day. And then similarly, we didn't see the big match. I know in England, obviously, it was very regional, depending upon where you lived. And we had Scott Sport, as it was called, on STV, which was similar to Sport Scene, but with Arthur Montford presenting, and a Scottish game first and foremost, and then catching up with English games after the fact.
I seem to remember Archie did some of the games at the 78 World Cup for Scotland, but Davy Coleman was... I don't know whether Archie did it for the Scottish audience when they played the Netherlands. He did.
But there's an interesting story about that, because actually for the Netherlands, I think it all worked. But the first game against Peru, there was a problem with Archie's connection. So Archie was in position to do the game for Scotland, but the line went down. So Scottish viewers ended up hearing David Coleman on that Scotland-Peru game. But yeah, that was the tradition back then, was that if Scotland were in the World Cup, and fortunately we tended to be at World Cups at that time, not so much nowadays, alas, but Archie would be there to do the game for the Scottish audience if Scotland were playing.
Now, JP, we talked about you throwing in at the deep end with BBC Radio Bristol. What was the next step in your career from that point?
I went to there wasn't a job for me full-time at BBC Radio Bristol, and although I was at one point told there was, midway through my finals year at Birmingham, so I left Birmingham, went down to Bristol to start the job on the Monday, whereupon I was told, what job? There's no job for you. The sports editor, he's a man called Ian Seymour, he's no longer with us, and told me a bit of a fib. Anyway, so I had to phone up Birmingham University, please, please take me back on, which they were reticent to do. I'm not surprised. I was never there. I was always playing football. But anyway, so then I went to the National Broadcasting School in London, did a 12-week postgrad course, which I did law and stuff like that, and news reporting, and came back and worked for Radio West, as it was. Again, this is how lucky I've been, right? I went there as a job in freelance. It was I got paid £100 a week, and the first day I was there was a Monday. I was just to go there as a reporter, and the sports editor had been rushed to hospital with an appendix. So that night I had to fill 10 minutes of a sports desk, the sports feature they did. And of course, I had so many connections in Bristol City and Bristol Rovers, and I loved it. And I worked there at Radio West. I did a lot of rugby because it was a massive rugby city at the time. And then I went to work in Sussex at the station there called Southern Sound, which was run by two people who taught me at the National Broadcasting School. I hated it. There. Lasted 6 months. Went back to Bristol. Went back to Radio West. And this was in a period where Bristol rugby was strong, Bath rugby was strong, Gloucestershire, Somerset, South West Division, Botham, Richards, Garner at Somerset. Wow. You know, what a wonderful... I was 21, I was a sports editor, and it was brilliant fun. And then London came calling, really. I felt I'd done enough. I couldn't go any further. And I went to work for a little thing called Club Call, which is a BT premium call service. You know, I was there for about 2 months in London. Just found my foot as a freelance in London. And I was editor for Birmingham, Arsenal, West Ham and Chelsea. And that really should be the end of that story. But when I started work at Capital, which was the following September, I think, I worked for BBC in London for a little while. That's where I knew Derek from. I worked there for about 7 months, I think it was, on what was called the BBC Radio 2 Sport National Local Radio Desk. So we'd have national sports stories that fed out to the local stations. Capital came calling, and I was welcomed at all these football clubs in London. They gave me a massive welcome, and it really helped that whole thing set off. I know we're going to talk about it again in a minute. Couldn't work out why, Dance. And then I was... Johnny Lyle's office at West Ham, what a wonderful man. And I said, I am surprised, John, that you make me feel so welcome. And he pulled out of his desk a letter, an old-fashioned letter of introduction from Terry Cooper, who was Bristol City manager. Basically explaining, he obviously wasn't a very good judge of character, because he was saying what a good guy I was. It was a proper old fact. I'd heard about letters of introduction, references like that, but I'd never seen one. Yeah, so that's how it all started really for me. Yeah,
kind of Paddington Bear. Please look after this commentator.
It was,
thank
yeah,
you,
yeah. Sort of thing. A jar of marmalade in my rucksack.
That's lovely. Well, Terry Cooper was I only met him very briefly when he was Birmingham manager in the early 90s, when the club were going through a great deal of turmoil. But what a lovely man he was to deal with. He was quite acerbic, but I really got on with him quite well in those days, just from a fan perspective.
Yeah, I loved him.
Yeah, and a great fullback as well, we shouldn't forget, for club and country. Derek, there's Jonathan mentioning your association as the two of you at BBC London. Was that an initial move from Aberdeen to move straight to London, or what was your pathway?
No, I actually never worked permanently in London, although I was in London a lot because of the nature of the job. So what happened was, I mentioned my first game, Kilmarnock Dumbarton, and then so I got home from that game thinking this might be the one chance I'll get and I won't get another one for a long time. But there was a call from Charles Runcie, who was the head of sport for Radio Scotland at the time. He subsequently moved to London to the sports room. And so my parents said, call Charles Runcie, he wants to talk to you. And I thought, oh, well, I've no idea if I've done well here. Am I going to get told that, no, oh, you know, they tried me and they won't try me again. But actually what he had to say was that they liked what I did. And the second game was England against Scotland, if I was up for it, in midweek. Did I want to do England against Scotland at Wembley? Wow. I'd never even been to Wembley at that point in my life. And it was because David Francie, my hero, my mentor, if you like, was still unfit to go. So that was my second game on the air. And it was to begin 5 years with the BBC in Scotland as really their commentator, although in those days they used to call the title sports assistant. That was the title that you had, sports assistant for BBC Radio Scotland, which sounds a bit underwhelming, but you did everything. You know, you did everything from the morning sports updates to going to Rangers or Celtic to get interviews with managers and players, and occasionally going down to London for courses and for meetings. And that's, you know, where I met JP and other people in the BBC business at that time. And it was quite a fortuitous time, I think, to be working in Scotland, because if you remember, it was post-Heysel, and the English teams were not in Europe at that particular time. Scottish teams were, and were quite good. So in my first season, I followed Dundee United all the way to the UEFA Cup final.
Oh, Paul Sturrock in that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that great team of Jim McLean and, you know, places like Barcelona. You know, imagine Dundee United going to Barcelona, to the Camp Nou, and winning. Borussia Mönchengladbach, who they beat in the semi-final, lost, unfortunately, to Gothenburg in the final. But I was exposed to all that at a very young age, and then countless other places. I think I can count, because somebody wanted me to count once upon a time at that stage. I think I managed to go to 19 countries with Scottish clubs in that five-year period, which tells you a lot about the success relative to nowadays of Scottish teams in Europe. And I would meet all these you know, English colleagues who I'd never met before, purely because the newspapers from England and colleagues from Radio 2, as it was at the time, would follow along with no English clubs in Europe.
Now, if my second major fixture had been England, Scotland at Wembley, I know I'd have been panning myself. But something tells me, Derek, that because of the grounding you gave yourself with that little tape recorder at Pataudry, something tells me that you felt you were almost ready for it, or you weren't quite as nervous as some of us would have been.
It's a really good way to put it, Dance, because I often think back to that night. It was an evening game. It was a midweek game in 1986, just before the World Cup. And I don't remember feeling nervous at all. Whereas if I did that now, I think the adrenaline would be pumping much more. And I think it was a function of the fact that I just was sort of living my dream at that point. And you see that often, I think, with young footballers, don't you? You see, you know, 17, 18-year-olds. And I think we all as commentators sometimes remark, you know, he looks as though he's got nerves of steel, this boy. He doesn't have a care in the world. And I think that was me at that point. I was focused on the task. But I do think that if you get into it young and you build your own sort of discipline and your own standards, you're actually building a body of work without really knowing it. You know, maybe you're not the polished commentator, and I certainly wasn't the polished commentator at 19 that you would hope that you might be, you know, 30, 40 years later. There certainly was some experience that had gone into it. And I just was thrilled to be given this chance. As I said, I was, you know, living my own dream.
It's an amazing story.
And also, throughout your career, you have been Derek Ray. Now, I know that sounds simplistic, but you haven't been Derek Ray trying to be David Coleman or Francie or Barry or any of these others. And I would say that would be my biggest piece of advice, Dance, to anyone coming in. And I do hear a lot of people on the radio and on television trying to be something they're not, trying to have a voice on television or radio that's not their normal voice, and trying to imitate other commentators. And don't do it. Be yourself, because in the end, yourself has to come through. And if it's belated in your career, it won't work. So do it now. Be yourself all the way through. That's what I would say.
I could not agree more, JP. I mean, I was thrust into it. My path was very different to you two guys because you were grounded in it from a very young age. I came into broadcasting at the age of 30 and was doing football commentaries at the age of 31, having led a completely different life up to that point. So I but yes, I think that the part of me said, don't try and, ape something that you've watched on television. Just, I was doing off-air commentaries from moment one. As you'll know, JP, the way that Capital Gold worked was you did off-air commentary of every game you did so they could use goal clips because that's what they had the rights for. So you're straight in at the deep end for Walsall Chesterfield. This was my first ever game. And you and my boss, Tom Ross, would give me notes. He would listen to the tape and kick the bad habits out of me within weeks. And I knew what to do and what not to do. But you're right, you've got to be yourself. I like to have a sense of humour around the games I'm doing without being too self-indulgent about it or excluding the audience. But I've always tried to have a little bit of fun if the co-commentators are up for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you have to. It's not rocket science. It's not brain surgery. It's not going to get man off this planet, is it? It's football. It's football. It's there to be enjoyed. Have a laugh. Why not?
Yeah.
And I think it's a good point that JP makes. If you think back to, and we've mentioned Coleman and Motson and Davis, and I mentioned Brian Moore. If you think about these giants of a previous era in broadcasting, you could listen to one sentence of any of those aforementioned commentators and know immediately that is John Motson, that is Barry Davis, that is Brian Moore. And I think it's really good advice. It's a little bit like, I used to play golf as a youngster, and in those days there wasn't a lot of formal golf instruction, but you would watch the really good players and you would try to sort of take and take little things from what they did, but then you would come up with something that is your own. You would try to find a sort of a basic grounding in what works and what you should do as a football commentator, but then absolutely put your own stamp on it and make sure that nobody is left in any doubt. That is Jonathan Pierce, that is Ian Danter.
I tried to throw darts like John Lowe with the John Lowe darts I had in my garage. Never hit a 180. Those darts were too big. I couldn't believe you could get three darts that size into a treble 20 bed.
I'll tell you what, Dan, I was incredibly fortunate again to have, I was approached when I was at the BBC on this local radio national desk at Radio 2. By Capital to go and set up their sport. They went over there. They didn't have a sport at the time. Matthew Bannister, who was head of news, came and had a lunch with me, and he said, I want you to come here. We've got something in mind. You need to speak to the head of programming called Richard Park, who Derek will know very well from Scotland days. Anyway,
I know him well too.
I'll explain that in a minute, because Richard was a very hard man to work for. He had a thing called the Vulcan death grip, which you used to use. You used to get hold of your arm and just say, apologies for the accent, Derek. But he'd say, what on earth was that, son? What on earth was that? And you go, what? Saturday's programme. What on earth was that? And you think, oh, God, my God, what part of the programme? What 2 minutes is he thinking? And you'd have to say, which part? The whole lot. The whole lot, 4.5 hours of utter rubbish. And then that was Monday morning, 6 o'clock. But he had this idea, set up Capital Gold, and he said to me, be yourself. Just be yourself. And it's a cliche, and we talk about this a lot on I've got a podcast called JP&T, The Football Friendly, with the comedian Terry Alderton, and we talk about this a lot on there, about, it's not the cliche is fan with a mic. We weren't the fan with a mic, but we understood what fans, I think, wanted in that area. Richard did. And he just said, represent them, be there, be the fan in the stadium that can't go because you can't afford it. Take them into the stadium, paint the pictures that take them there, transport them into so that they have this big thing in their life made even bigger. And he created this thing that just started with the London clubs. And by the time it finished, by the time I left in 2002, the Capital Gold Empire was huge. We had 72 of the 92 clubs with commentary rights. They bought into Birmingham and took over what was a fantastic radio station called BRMB. Tom Ross was there, as you know, Dance, and you all became part of that great empire. And it was infused with this same message: just do it for the supporters. I thought it was just a wonderful experience to be part of.
And I think, Dance, JP deserves a lot of credit for changing the tone of how football on the radio was broadcast in the UK. Because if you think about it before that, and I remember people saying to me, oh, Jonathan Pierce on Capital is really interesting what he does. It's a different style. And you would listen to it and you would think, yeah, it is different. Because what had happened before was that the old-fashioned BBC way of presenting football on the radio was very good, very descriptive, very wordy. But it was sort of ivory towers a bit. It was a bit kind of, you know, we are going to sort of tell you what is happening from on high, looking down on this arena. And what JP was doing was, JP was basically saying, we're here in amongst the fans, we're here in amongst the punters, and this atmosphere is incredible, and it's absolutely rocking. And that was more the experience that we had as fans. You know, that was how we watch football. And so I think it was a sea change. And as, you know, as I said, you know, tip of the hat to JP for that.
I couldn't agree more. Speaking to Mick Lowes, one of your protégés on this podcast a little while ago, JP, he talked about those initial stages when he came in to work for you at Capital Gold, and some people in the press were going, oh, here come the shouters.
That's right, yeah.
Here yeah. come the noisy people. But it was important that austere broadcasting style. You couldn't copy it. You had to be yourself. And one commentary that sticks out for me from you, JP, very much wasn't even about football. It was the Eric Cantona kung fu kick at Selhurst Park, which, I mean, you listen back to that commentary, it's spine tingling, the way that something you could not possibly have prepped for with all the notes that you've done suddenly emerges. You've got to call it as you see it, and it's wow. I mean, what a moment to be present at.
It was bizarre, and you know, it was just surreal, really, what had happened. I was very close to Crystal Palace at the time, but I think at that stage we were also broadcasting for Manchester, you know, as part of the Capital Empire. I might be wrong there, but anyway, because that's the other thing we did. We took on Premier League games, Liverpool, Manchester United. There was a loophole in the agreement, and we started doing it until they closed the loophole. But it because London, of course, Manchester United have loads of fans in London, Liverpool, and so on and so forth. So we might have been doing it for Manchester as well at that time, and I was aware of that. But you just couldn't excuse what was happening in front of you. But I had no time to think about it, and that's another thing. I don't know whether Derek would agree with me on this, but I do hear a lot of commentary these days where people seem to have prepared lines, especially at the end of games, where they've got an either or written out, and then they go to them at the end of a commentary, and it just sounds wrong. You know, you're right. I had no way of, how could you prep? Richard Shaw doing an excellent man-for-man job on Eric Cantona. Eric Cantona reacting horribly, getting sent off, and then kicking a fan. You know, in the way that he did. I mean, it was just surreal. And I was lucky enough to, Capital were lucky enough to win a Sony for that one. And but we were under a lot of pressure, boys. Richard Park put us under a lot of pressure. The Sonys, if people don't know, they're the equivalent of the Radio Oscars. But it wasn't like, wow, boys, you've won the Sony this year. We were expected to win it every year. And if we didn't win a Sony, and I was lucky enough to win six in all, but if we didn't win a Sony, it was a post-mortem. I remember one year we did it when we'd been told we hadn't won it. Richard told us we hadn't won it, right? But we still had to go to the lunch. So Losey and I went to the lunch, and as you probably both know, Capitals were a little bit like the Wild West back in those days. You know, we played hard and lived very hard. Anyways, we weren't going to win this award, so there wasn't going to be a speech. So we got absolutely trolleyed, right? On the way to wherever it was, the Grosvenor House, we got trolleyed. Pitched up at the Grosvenor. I'm sitting next to Chris Tarrant. He carries on drinking with me. We get bladdered there as well. And then up gets Michael Aspel, and he's gone, the winner of the sports award, best sports programme of the year, goes to Cat, and that's all he got out. He was going to say Capital Gold, but all he got, and then he just heard this from the floor up, and we had to get up. And I've gone up and I said, I am so surprised or so shocked since I announced to my mother-in-law I was going to get married to a daughter, and she screamed.
Oh, boy.
Whole hotel in front of us, silent. We walked off stage, and Michael Aspel turned around and said, yes, I thought the days of the football hooligan was over. Put us to bed, but yeah.
Well, Capital Gold was a behemoth. Well, that's what it became, as you say. And I don't know whether, because you've got a good perspective on this, JP, and Derek, you can come in on this as well from an outside point of view. But it seemed that Capital almost became a victim of its own success, in that in order to keep the exclusivity that you wanted, that you had to keep the BBC at arm's length with regard to the amounts of money that you eventually had to pay going up and up and up to keep that exclusivity.
Yeah, when we first did it, the cartel of six London clubs in the top flight, and it could have been eight, could have been 10, didn't matter. They were only going to get 30 grand a year. That was it, right?
Yeah.
By the time we finished, it wasn't the BBC we were keeping at bay. It was an emerging radio station close to your heart called Talk Sport.
Uh-huh.
And by the time we finished and Talk Sport had come along, the commentary deal had been dissipated, watered down, because Talk had taken a few of the clubs. We were paying £1 million a year for a club, and Talk were paying as much, if not more. And at that stage, it just got, because so many games were live on television as well, and the audience figures, therefore, we can dress up and say, look, the audience figures are great, 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 but they're not against live television. They don't hit. Mm. And the people who ran Capital Goal went, no, you know, we're not going to carry on doing it. And I actually got out. I went back to the BBC. But then, and that was the demise. It wasn't the BBC. It was the fact that the Talk came along. And when I listened to Talk Sport, I feel a little bit of pride, really, because a lot of you I knew through the Capital Empire, and I think had it not been for Capital Gold, I don't think there would have been a Talk Sport. And what you've done is pick up the ball and run with it, as Richard Park would say.
I think that's
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is mentioning Richard Park there. So when I started at the BBC, Richard was Mr. Everything at Radio Clyde, who were then the rivals of BBC Radio Scotland.
Yes, he used to present, didn't he?
I'll tell you a story about Richard Park. I remember one night at Pataudry in Aberdeen. It was an Aberdeen Celtic game, and he was presenting the programme, which was, you know, half an hour beforehand, commentating on the whole match, and then doing the wrap-up at the end, which probably took him till about, I don't know, 10 o'clock. And I remember then driving back with a colleague to Glasgow, where I was living at the time, and putting on my radio when I got home, which would have been about 12:30, and Richard Park was on the radio, having himself made that drive back to Glasgow to do the late night show on Radio Clyde. So, I mean, that was Richard Park, and he was very innovative. He probably wasn't happy. You mentioned the Sony Awards. I finished ahead of him in 1987, winning the Sony Award, and he didn't. I'm sure that rankled, because he was a very competitive chap, as we know. But my goodness, you know, what a radio hero for so many people. And I never worked for him. I only knew him as a colleague who worked for the rival station. But he's left his legacy, no doubt about that.
I met him once, because by the time he came into BRNB, when I was actually doing a comedy show, one of the things I did, as well as the sport, I did a drive-time comedy show. And I remember him coming in, suddenly unannounced that he came in, because his son, Paul Jackson, was the program controller at BRNB. And, you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree there, I can tell you, with regard to Paul. But Richard just came into the spare studio where I was working with my two writers and said, play me what you got. So whatever sketch or parody song we have for that day, he wanted to hear it there and then. So I've had to play him this parody song, and he's just standing there impassive, listening to this. And I'd heard stories. I'd heard the Pat Sharp red card story and all sorts, and thought, oh boy, this is how the career ends. And he just, at the end of it, I stopped the mini display. He said, excellent, well done, and walked off. He did barely a flicker of emotion, but he was just happy that the ship was steady at this place that his son was working at. But yeah, he was a fearsome individual.
Brilliant though, brilliant.
Yeah.
He was brilliantly supportive to me. He managed to find funds in the early years that weren't earmarked for sport and keep us going and fund that growth. And he had this, you know, what we had this dream of a national network sports station where we were going to bring in American sports overnight, like golf, like talk to, like racing from America, American football. And it was the dream. I thought they chickened out a little bit in the end, which was disappointing. But when he was in Scotland, Derek, did he do an agony aunt? Wasn't he do a program called Dr. Dick or something?
Doctor, what was it? Doctor Dr. Dick's nighttime surgery or something. I'm not doing it justice, but it was a late night program that he would. So he would sort of morph into this different character for that. I mean, a very talented guy. Brilliant. And, you know, he did a daytime, you know, DJ show. And then, you know, his personality would change subtly as a football commentator, as a football presenter. You know, the joke was that it's not Radio Clyde. It's actually Radio Richard. That's what it really should be called.
Well, I bet that same idea with Dr. Dick's late night surgery, I bet that's what he told Jeremy Kyle to do, because that was the Jeremy Kyle's moment at BRNB was when he was made to do a late night phone in, which was called Late and Live. And his producer was called Dr. Sex, because it was just about people ringing in with sex. But I remember Jess at his first show, he told the story about catching his first wife in bed with another man to sort of try and elicit callers. And I remember seeing the phone bank going ballistic. I thought, well, they're onto a hit here. So Richard would have definitely had a hand in that particular moment in Jeremy Carr's career, Jezza, as he was known back then. You mentioned actually, JP, about, you know, non-scripted lines, and I'm completely with you on that. So which part of your brain does Tony Adams' Eeyore way scores for Arsenal come from?
It was absolutely spontaneous. People don't think it was. But then people have an opinion, so bizarre opinions of commentary. I read newspaper articles the other day that apparently Match of the Day commentators aren't at the games. They do a 5-minute edit commentary afterwards, which is absolute baloney. No, that Adams thing was, and I'll tell you again. We talk on about this has come up on the podcast because I've been asked about that as well. Mm. Had I ever done a line that I'd written down before, and post that he always gets it right for Arsenal. Line about Adams. I tried to replicate that about 6 months later when he scored again with a pre-prepared line, and it was so hideous. In my ears, it was so hideous. I never ever did it again. Mm. And I think people dream of doing. I don't know what Derek thinks about it. I think people, some commentators come in and dream of doing, they think it's all over, it is now lines. And actually, Richard Park said to me once, very early on in the Capital, he said, stop reaching for the big lines. Mm. They'll just come. Don't reach for the big lines. He was such a brilliant man, you know. Yeah. And stop reaching for the big lines. And you do hear people, I think, in commentary now. I listened to someone commentating the other night on a cup tie. It was a shock, and reaching for the big line at the end, and there were pauses as they were reaching for a line that didn't come. And don't do it.
Mm. Yeah, I'm with you on that one, JP. And I think that there's a tendency now to feel as a commentator, and I hear this from younger commentators coming through, that they need to impress the producer with this big line, because that's what's going to grab attention. And I think in the social media world, that does grab attentions, because it's often what people hear. You know, they hear a clip of a goal and they hear that line and they want to be able to emulate that line. But I've always, you know, if anybody cares about my opinion, I've always said to younger commentators, worry about the 90 minutes of commentary, because that's how I would judge a commentator. What is it like listening to him or her over the course of 90 minutes? That really should be the test of how well we're doing. You know, one line here or there, it should be spontaneous. It should be something that fits the moment rather than something that is canned. And, you know, one of my great heroes, and I'm sure probably for all of us, I've never worked in cricket, but I've always had an admiration for the sport, the late, great Richie Beno. And if you think about some of the lines that he uttered down the years, you could tell there was nothing scripted about them at all. There were simply things that just occurred to him in the moment. He said it with that very understated delivery. You know, one of my favorites is talking about captaincy, and I'm not quite as good as Dance when it comes to impersonations, but I'll give you my best Richie. And, you know, I think what he said was, well, captaincy is 90% skill and 10% luck, but don't try it without the 10%. End of story. You know, and lines like that are just lines that come, you know, from, you don't even know where. They suddenly pop up in your brain and you say them, and hopefully they match the moment.
Beno was amazing. I remember that line where both of them smashed Terry Alderman.
The confectionery stand. Yeah.
Yes, that's gone straight into the confectionery stall and out again. Yeah, and that's right. And he didn't say anything else for 30 seconds because you've got the applause, you've got both of them, you know, raising his bat.
Didn't Alderman, need to say anything else.
Alderman yeah. grimacing as he goes back to his mark. Perfect. Yeah,
how about Peter Alice then? Peter Alice could do a fantastic commentary with just this noise. Oh, 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 oh.
Yeah.
Oh. That was yeah. it.
Hello.
That's all he had. Yeah. Fun. He was a, you know, doyen. Yeah.
Yes.
O'Sullivan, doyen. These are wonderful people, you know, yeah. wonderful commentators.
I think that's that the era that we grew up in. Certainly Bill McLaren.
And
Harry Carpenter and things like, goodness me, we were spoilt with the quality of commentators. Now, Derek, I want to get back to you because you've led this wonderfully nomadic existence as a commentator on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Including a period of time where you were using the red eye to come back to the UK to do games. I mean, I don't know how long that lasted and how long before your brain was fried, but tell me about the circumstances that led to that.
I'll give you the abbreviated version sort of after 1991. So I decided that I wanted to live in America. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but there was a fascination there. And I'd made some contacts with people who were working for the 94 World Cup. And so basically landed in Boston, having done 5 years at the BBC, freelance for a while, enrolled at a local college to try to find out more about how broadcasting is done in America. And a few months later, I got a job offer to be press officer for the World Cup in Boston. And again, I bumped into JP on my travels there because England were to come to Boston to lose to the United States. Sorry to have to bring that one up again. In 1993 as part of the US Cup. And I was the press officer for that. And it was sort of a test run for the World Cup. And so I did that in 94 and really learned an awful lot. You see things from the inside in a way that you never would as a commentator. You know, and obviously the Maradona controversy was a big part of my brief at that point because what sadly happened to Maradona happened in the Boston venue. All the drama came in Dallas afterwards after they'd moved away from Boston. But that was a sort of a round-the-clock job. So I was still doing bits of freelance broadcasting, some Champions League closed-circuit games, as was the case at the time. And then after the World Cup in 94, ESPN got wind of the fact that I was in the area. They had just started up an international football service, Dutch football, Brazilian football, and the Champions League. And they asked, would I like to come on board? So I did that. I did some South American highlights for a company called CSI at that time, and then started with MLS doing the games of the New England Revolution. Was never totally comfortable in MLS, though, I have to say, because they didn't really let me do it my way. They were very much as a league into micromanaging the broadcast so that you couldn't be critical of very much of anything, couldn't criticize the league, couldn't criticize players, couldn't criticize referees. And after a few years, I said, this is not for me. I'd rather just be permanently, you know, doing the international game or the club game at a high level. And so stayed with ESPN throughout the 2000s. And you mentioned then what happened at the end of that decade was to change my life a bit, because if you remember the sequence of events, Satanta suddenly hit financial trouble in the UK or worldwide with all their operations. And ESPN came in 2009 and essentially a very short notice picked up the Satanta Premier League rights and the Scottish Premiership rights, Premier League as it was called at that time. And so it was put to me, would you fancy going back to the UK after all these years and being part of this new ESPN team that we're suddenly having to throw together? They said that the snag is that we still need you to do stuff here in the States, so we'd fly you in and out. So I was doing that. I was flying on a Thursday, arriving on a Friday, doing a game at places like Falkirk and Hibs and Hearts on a Saturday, and then sometimes flying back and then having to present a program from the studio at ESPN in Bristol, Connecticut on a Sunday. So we did this for a whole season. And then I think we all realized this wasn't sustainable, you know, on a number of levels. So we made the change for me to move to London. And so from 2010 until 2017, I was London-based, initially with ESPN UK, and then when the ESPN UK operation folded with BT Sport, who took on many of the rights. And of course, JP still does stuff there. And that was my bread and butter for a while, as well as other projects. But 7 years back in the UK. And then after that, decided to move back. And as I say, Germany's always been at the sort of the heart of what I've done. And there was a chance I knew by moving back I'd still be able to keep my Germany work and be there regularly. And that remains the case. And that's a bit of a labor of love as far as I'm concerned.
What was it actually like, taking those red eyes? How much of a toll did it take on you having to do that for a whole year or as long as it was?
Yeah, it got old towards the end of it. At the start, the adrenaline was pumping because I was honestly thrilled to be back in the UK market. It's something I'd been hoping for, not really expecting that that opportunity would come up. Because if you think about it, as commentators, we don't always move around that much. Once you sort of have a gig and a main gig, that becomes your commentating identity almost for life a little bit. But there was this chance to go back, and I was really motivated by it, and I wanted to be able to contribute to what ESPN were doing. And I was excited to be back in my own, you know, football country of Scotland as well. Having been away for a long time, it was back to my roots and back to the same venues where I'd started. And it was interesting meeting some of the people who'd been players, young players, when I started as a commentator who were now managers, you know, and sort of just comparing notes and kit men and some of the same kit men who'd been there 20 years before and stories like that. But yeah, towards the end of it, I think it just got really tiring because, you know, I was not flying business class. I was flying, you know, just as one would normally fly back and forth, and you know, 8-hour flights through the night. Yeah, after a while, and then having to go straight on the air could be a bit tough. So I was delighted when it was suggested that that maybe we move the operation to London.
I was about to ask, was there ever a point where you turned left? But clearly not. It's a life ambition of mine to turn left at some point when I get on a plane, but it hasn't happened yet. There we go. I still hold out hope.
Yeah, for all
amazing.
Of us, yeah.
JP, you mentioned leaving Capital Gold in the early 2000s. You sensed that particular part of your journey needed to change. So what was the sequence of events there?
I didn't really have much choice. Richard Parker had left. Boardroom coup. His management style, I think, had rubbed up a few in senior boardroom level the wrong way. Richard left. I asked him, I phoned him up. I was told that he was leaving. I phoned him up and said, I want you to see if there's a loophole in my contract that I can go when you go. And he tried for me and said no. So I stayed on. This was 2001, 2002. And the person who came in and replaced him didn't like me. That's fine. Didn't fancy me. That's fine. I didn't rate her at all. And but silly things happened, like I had a phone call. I had a company card, credit card, you know. So rather than all the freelancers going out and rattling up expenses and having to do it all back and forth, I say put it on the credit card and then it will go through the one account. I get a phone call, and I'd have, you know, everyone has phones now, but they weren't an automatic thing then. Mm-hmm. I had a phone call in midweek saying, you need to return your company credit card and your company phone. And I said, how can I do the job? Well, you need to get them back into us straight away. And I said, look, you want me to go? If you want me to go, I'll go. I want you to go. I said, that's fine. This was the December. That's fine. I said, I've got 6 months leave owing me and time in lieu. So that's fine. I'm finished then, effectively. And then I got a phone call on the Friday saying, we haven't got anyone to present the sports programme tomorrow. Duh. And so I then negotiated a new 6-month contract to stay. But 2002 was coming up. And Bob Shannon, who'd started at BBC, the BBC Two Sport, the week I started, contacted me and said they wanted me to go back to the BBC. They must have realised something was up. They wanted me to go back to the BBC to work on Radio 5 Sport and present out at grounds, which they hadn't done. And Dance, you know, this is what we were doing. This is the bread and butter of independent local radio, to present from the grounds.
Yeah.
As Derek very kindly said earlier, to give, you know, that we were amongst the supporters. So he wanted to do that with 5 Live for the first time. They were starting to think about only going one commentator instead of two. And he, as Bob said to me, he said, I want you to come back in and break a few heads, knock a few heads together. So I went back in. It wasn't universally acclaimed. There were one or two people, senior commentators, who didn't like me being around the place. That was very evident. But anyway, that's how it happened. And I was very sad to see Capital Gold go within a year. And I was really, really, it broke my heart. broke my heart because a lot of people were affected, and it broke my heart. But that's how I went back to the BBC. And then Niall Sloan, who was a brilliant man, now ITV head of sports, said he wanted me to do TV, wanted me to take over from Motti. That never quite happened, and which I'm okay with. And that's how it happened, really. I just started there.
And Channel 5 came along as well, didn't it? You know, Thursday nights, Channel 5.
Before then, Sky in 1992, whenever it was, I did Games of Sky and presented things like the Footballers Football Show and the Boss, the series with managers. That went on for a while. And then I think it was mid-90s and 97. Again, Channel 5 approached me. They wanted to do things in a different way. They wanted to be myself. And the first game we did was England in Poland, which they presented from a pub back at home. Remember, apparently it was disastrous back at home.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's June, right? So we were over there. I think it was June, whatever. Anyway, it was supposed to be warm. I've got a shirt. That's all I've got, you know. And it turned out to be bleak, like temperatures down towards zero. And I had to borrow, Peter Taylor was involved with England at the time, gave me one of their big padded but very, very branded coats from the dugout. So the first time there, this is how bad it was, right? I love working for Channel 5 because it really was cowboy TV back in the day. And anyway, so I'm on the gantry. This is about 2 hours before kickoff, wearing this big branded, that's people don't know, you don't do that. It's outlawed. This big branded jacket. And then the cameraman's waving frantically at me like this. He's waving at me, and I've looked at him. I'm all huddled up doing the last minute notes. And he's gone, "You're on." On what? I've no idea what I'm on. And apparently I've been asked a question from this pub setup. I think they had a jockey in there doing it, or a race commentator doing it. I don't know what was in this, back in the studio. Anyway, yeah. I've no idea what am I on? Have they asked me a question? What am I doing? So I went through this 45 seconds of utter waffle, which people will know I've been doing for 42 years anyway. And then the commentary came an hour and a half later. That's what it was like. But I loved it because it was proper, you know, edge of your seat stuff.
There's a name I've got to throw at you, JP. Actually, I neglected to do so when we were talking about Capital Gold, because, and Derek will have names, I'm sure, that have meant a lot to him, that the people that aren't in front of the microphone but make an inordinate difference to the way that a broadcast comes together. And there's a chap called Pete Simmons whose name keeps coming up, JP, who was the main sports producer at Capital Gold. Is that right?
Yeah, we worked together. Pete and I worked together. I was editorially in charge and developing the team. Pete, I think his first degree was physics or something like that. He was a brilliant man. Then he did his master's in music, and he had an unbelievable ear, for what sounded good in speech and music radio, and it was phenomenal. I mean, he won loads of awards, and he was brilliant, and so he was driving the desk. And don't forget, we were co-producing this live. I was at the ground. He was back in the studio. And it was a sort of an instinctive relationship. I've never experienced it with anyone else. He was the best producer I've ever had in my life, and people will say the same thing about him. But it's the ear. And when people think about radio, and sometimes I'll say it to you, I've said it to you personally about TalkSport. Mm. Sometimes I think your producers don't listen to the sound of the programme, the punctuation of the programme, the sound punctuation, which you have to have for radio. And he had it. I'd be interested to hear what Derek thinks about this.
Mm. Well, the late, great Brian Moore, I think, spoke about this. And he spoke about, and this is related to what you're saying, JP, he spoke about how the words are important, but sometimes the way we use the words can be more important. And there is a kind of a, you know, I think we all really appreciate good broadcasting when we hear it, good commentating. And sometimes, yeah, the words can be pivotal to that. But if you just think about it, it's almost like singing a song. And I always think that at our best, it's a bit like the same discipline as a singer. You find the right note here, 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 and here. And it just all fits together. And there are some producers who absolutely have that, and probably underappreciated.
I've always found going to games myself, for the people that don't know, when you go as a commentator, I'm pretty self-sufficient, don't often have a producer on site with me. Sometimes I do nowadays, but quite often it's just me and my summariser, and we've got a producer back at base. So I've got my broadcast box, a couple of headset microphones for me and my summariser to use, but also the effects microphone. which you just lay somewhere. And there's an art, I've always felt, to getting that balance between the effects of hearing the crowd and your own voices. Something that you got to fight against a little, gents. Do you know what I mean? Just that thing where you're just pushing yourself a little bit, not so that it sounds unnatural, but just so that you know you got something to work against.
It's the one thing that drives me mad at times when I know that we're doing games off tube particularly, and it can vary. Sometimes it's perfect, but there are times when you'll maybe listen back to something and you'll say, hang on, the crowd is way down here. When I was broadcasting the game, it was really loud in my ears and I was trying to use it as a soundtrack. Mm. And that can be really annoying to me because I always think that the natural soundtrack of the crowd really should come through, and as commentators, we can use that to our advantage.
Yeah, back to Richard Park as well. You come up with a phrase there, Dan, fight the crowd. Mm. And he said that he wanted that. He wanted the commentators fighting the crowd. It's because, and going back to what Derek said earlier on, Radio 2 Sport, the Brian Butlers, Peter Jones, who were great icons and huge influence on me, the sound level was so low, you wouldn't have known they were at a football match. So Richard said, fight the crowd. And that's what we did. And Pete made sure the balance was right, and he played music under features and stuff. We were the first to do that live, and it was all well timed. And the end of the program was all back timed. It was all the first time this had all happened because he was such a great producer. But again, I'll agree with what Derek has just said. Sometimes when you're doing it off tube, you have no control over the sound mix. For example, in the World Cup finals, we go to, the sound and everything for the TV is done by the host broadcaster. So if you're working, Derek was working with the Americans, I was working with BBC here, you don't really have a control over that necessarily all the time. And I'll take example. The example I will use is Argentina against Mexico. It's the best atmosphere I've ever experienced at any World Cup game ever in my life on any continent. It was unbelievable. And I kept saying in the commentary, and people back home, I've then contacted people back home and going, why do you keep saying that? It wasn't great. And I'm thinking, well, didn't you not hear it?
Yeah.
And they hadn't heard it.
Which is why when we used to go to Grants, I think of Ninian Park straight away as a terrifying place to go, even as a neutral, just somebody sitting in the press box. They played like Men of Harlech through that scratchy old PA system at Ninian Park and Bread of Heaven just before the players walked out. Frightening, but I wanted that to come across to the listeners that, that look, this is the atmosphere that Warsaw are walking into. This is what they've got to cope with this afternoon, because this is proper intense, horrible, you know, intense rivalry. It's hard to explain, really, but I always wanted that to come across. So something as simple as that little tweak of the effects microphone can make all the difference.
You have more control in radio, though, and you have a better. You're speaking to the person directly. Yeah. You have that conversation with the listener directly. It's you to the listener. That's direct. Mm. I don't ever get that feeling in TV. There's too many people involved,
and you've got people in your ear all the time as well. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would add, I think that we are slightly at the low end of the totem pole as commentators, as sound people on TV. You sort of get the feeling that in radio, if you think about it, without commentary, without crowd noise, there is no event. You know, Dan, you are the event on radio. On TV, there's still an event without us. And there are times when I definitely think, okay, yeah, the sound is a consideration, but it's not the main consideration of the broadcast. And yeah, that can be a bit aggravating.
You still do radio now and again, don't you, JP?
Yeah, I do. I do half a dozen. A year for Five Live, and I really enjoy it. I did Oxford against Arsenal with the white shirts and for the charity and the white numbers on the back of the shirts at Oxford on Monday, which was a bit problematic. But yeah, I do. And the comedian Kevin Day on the podcast JP and Cedar Football Friendly, I give it another plug there, Dan. This week, he was saying to me, "What's the main difference between the radio and TV?" And I will ask Mr. Derek Ray for his first opinion on this. What does he think the major difference is? And then I'll give him what I think.
For me, the major difference is that radio is, if you like, the theatre of the mind. You know, when you're listening to radio, you have a bit more artistic license in radio because you can tell your own narrative within the confines of what's actually happening. TV, you've got to be a bit more sort of by the book and almost edit yourself in TV. I think good commentary on TV is actually editing yourself and pairing it back so it blends in rather than overpowers. But radio has its own, I would say, theatre of the mind quality.
Marks out of 10 for that answer, JP?
10.
Okay.
he's paying me. I think this is what I said the other day, was you paint the pictures for the radio, it's suspension of disbelief, which is the old Shakespearean thing, wasn't it? Them there, you paint the drama, and on television you're qualifying it, you're just qualifying the pictures and helping them along, I think, and coming up with an explanation, perhaps, an explanation of what's going on in the game, trying to tell people what's going to happen in the game in the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the game. I think on television you have more license to do that, perhaps, than you do on the radio, because the radio, you're in the there and now, painting the picture. So television, I think you can be a little bit more predictive. I enjoy both. TV, we have better positions. Radio, you're nearer the fans. So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other for me.
Yeah, but then the gantries can leave you rather exposed to the elements, can't they?
Well, and also a long, long, long way away. One or two of the positions in Doha were a long way away. West Ham's position is, you're miles from the far corner flag. You are miles. That's the same for radio, mind you.
As well, I went to do Torquay Derby in the first round of the FA Cup not so long ago, and they plonked me behind the goal. They didn't have room for me on the halfway line. So I was plonked behind the goal with fairly sort of yellowish floodlights, I will say, not the brightest. And of course, all the action happened at the other end. So luckily I was only doing reports and not, if I'd been doing commentary that day, I would not had a Scooby-Doo who equalised for Torquay late on to force a replay. It would have completely passed me by, but you're panicking, waiting for them to come to you for an update, and you're looking at the player sprinting away, and you're trying to find the number on the back of the shirt. Mm-hmm. And if it was Arsenal, like the other night, with white numbers on a white shirt, there's a number of teams who wind me up like that. Sheffield Wednesday, West Bromwich Albion have long since had, you know, illegible numbers on the back of striped shirts. I don't really understand why.
But we had a few at the World Cup, Dan, so we had quite a few at the World Cup like that.
What do you do, Derek, when the players come out to warm up? What do you do?
I bet we do similar things. I always have the binoculars, and I always look at boot colours, and I look at armbands and hairstyles. Have they changed? And yeah, I'm sure you do the same thing. Would I be right?
Yeah, I do. And it's a nightmare, isn't it, when they warm up, number 11 warms up in a pair of yellow Adidas boots or whatever, and then comes out for the game and he's changed them to green Umbro, whatever it is. I don't know what boot.
It almost sounds deliberate, doesn't it? It's almost like they're trolling you, JP.
Did poor old Barry Davis in France 98, was it Barry who had to do... Oh, no, I think it might have been Gubba, Tony Gubba. Romania were at war with their press. And so... Didn't they all come out with blonde, bleached hair?
That was USA 94, wasn't it? That was America, was it? Or was it 98?
I think it was 98.
I think it was 98, yeah.
Oh, forgive me.
It was Tony Gubba, and they had no warning. And all of a sudden, you know...
They've all got bleached blonde hair.
Yeah, 10, long black hair, whatever. No, they're all bleached blonde. That's a nightmare.
That's not fun. That's not fun at all. But yeah, I'm with you, Derek. I look for little sweatbands or armbands or things like that. Sometimes tattoos, even, you know, you can see a tattoo halfway down someone's shirt and something like that, and that can be an identifying factor. It's ridiculous.
I forget which team it was now, because we did so many games during the World Cup, didn't we?
Yeah.
But there was I can't remember who it was now, but while they were warming up, because I've got the binoculars, and, you know, you try to memorize hairstyles and faces and things like that, but they all were wearing the same number on their shorts during the warm-up. They all had number 11. I'm thinking, why? I can't remember who it was now.
No.
I remember thinking, okay, all right, well, I'm not going to be able to do what I usually do with this team.
We kept bumping into each other, Derek and I, in car parks over there. Not that we were hanging around car parks, but we did so many games, you'd sort of say hello. You'd be getting out of a car, I'd be getting out of a car. He'd say hello, you know, where are you next, blah, blah, blah. And then off he'd go into the sunset. I wouldn't see him for 3 or 4 more days in another car park.
Yeah. This is it. This is what people need to... About commentators, we have fleeting moments with one another. Yeah. We have 3 or 4 minutes in each other's company, and then suddenly duty calls somewhere else and we have to disappear off. So we maintain this myriad of short-term relationships with our peers. And we'd love to spend longer in each other's company, but it's just not feasible, is it?
No, and it's not true of all commentators. I'm not too sure I'd like to spend common time with all commentators.
Present company accepted, of course.
Of course, mate.
Good.
Of course.
So we've been chatting for well over an hour. I guess we need to wrap this up at some point. I mean, Derek has very kindly got up at the stupid o'clock to record this podcast as he's over there on the east coast of the United States. How did you get on with the cyclone bomb, by the way, Derek? Because they had that ridiculous weather that hit the east coast, didn't you?
Yeah, we were actually very lucky, Dance, here in the Boston area. We had read the forecasts and it was particularly bad in many areas of the Northeast. But for some reason, normally here in the Boston area, we're right on the coast. And I'm looking outside at the moment. We've got some snow on the ground. And, you know, normally we get some pretty bad weather here, but we were spared. It was actually just a lot of high wind. And I went down to the Atlantic and looked at it because it's sometimes very impressive looking at the Atlantic. And, you know, when there is a storm not too far away. But no, we escaped that one. I dare say that our luck will change pretty soon because winters here can be a bit rough.
But sport, and I'm thinking specifically of NFL, it goes ahead no matter what is happening weather-wise. I mean, some NFL games have been played out in the most atrocious conditions.
Yeah, this reminds me actually of my early days at ESPN when they had rights to Scottish football. And I remember there was a Hibernian Celtic game that we were supposed to cover. And I remember I called the programming person on the Friday. It was the first season with the rights. And I said to them, there's a good chance that the game is going to be postponed. That's what I'm hearing from Edinburgh. And she was flabbergasted. She said, postponed? She goes, well, what's that? And I realized that it wasn't really in her vocabulary because in American sports, games, certainly in winter in the NFL, as you've said, are not postponed. That there is no New England Patriots versus New York Jets match postponed idea at all. they do play irrespective of the weather.
I've yet to do a game with the orange ball and snow on the ground and, you know, the 18-yard box is, you know, swept clear. In my career, and I've been doing this 20 years, I've not experienced that, but I guess you guys must have done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had one, in fact, when I was at BT Sport, Rangers on a Friday night, Rangers against, forget who it was against now, but the game started and it should never have really gone ahead. And I remember everything was white, the orange ball, and then after 25 minutes or so, they packed it in. They said, no, we can't. It's like a skating rink out there. We can't do it.
We did. When the loss of Gianluca Vialli the other day, who was a lovely man, wonderful man, reminded me of when I was doing Channel 5 and we did Tromso against Chelsea in the Cup Winners' Cup, I think it was, up in Tromso, beyond the Arctic Circle. And the snow came down and the snow on the pitch. But worse, Dance, there was a belt of snow. It's coming in horizontally and between the commentary box, which was high on a banked side stand.
Right.
And between me and the pitch. And so players disappeared. And occasionally, Luca Vialli's head would appear and head the ball. And so I would identify him, but that was just about it. And the difference between then and now is that we travel with the team. And we laughed about it all the way home. And every time I saw him, we laugh about it because you had that contact with the managers and the players that commentators coming through don't necessarily have nowadays. I hope that I'll carry on commentating on matches that last 90 minutes and not 60 minutes. I hope that I still commentate on replays in the days to come. I'm very privileged to have done what I've done. I've enjoyed speaking to you. And I love what I do, and I've loved to meet people like you over the years, and I'm privileged to have known Derek all these years now, going back. And I'd forgotten Derek about 94 and Boston.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful. I loved it over there. I loved America. I loved the whole thing, and I've just had such a whale of a time, you know, over the years. I'm privileged.
Yeah, well, you've had an amazing career, JP, and you've done so much. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, you know, I think you are the voice of a generation in terms, especially of radio, but also TV, because I think we should never underestimate the power of BBC, televised football on the BBC, Match of the Day. And I would agree with what you said. I think that as commentators, there really are very few of us who do this. You know, it's certainly more than used to be the case when I started, when you started, and you know, in the 1980s, for example, you could almost count on, you know, on one hand how many people actually did it for a living. Now there are many more, and we all have something in common. We all go through the same frustrations, the same things, and that's why it is great to bump into each other at World Cups and at other major championships, because there's always a line that we can share with each other. I think we all try to be generous, because you can't know absolutely everything, and you know, you might have something that I don't, and vice versa. And as you said, let's hope we can keep doing this a little while longer.
Well, you two have been an inspiration to me, most definitely, in having come into broadcasting as late as I did, because it wasn't until the late 1990s that I actually started working in broadcasting at all, never mind working as a football commentator. And I'll wager that everything Tom Ross used to say to me on a Monday morning after a commentary about telling me what to do, where's the ball? How long's gone? Which way are they kicking? What's the score? Keep telling them the score. Keep telling them the score. If there's a corner, which two stands is it between? I'll bet that that is exactly what JP would have been saying to his troops in the Capital Gold offices down in London at the same time about the ethos of radio commentary. So I owe you a great deal, JP. You may not realise that, but I owe you a great deal for what's
happening.
That's
very, very kind. That's very, very kind. Richard used to say to me, get an ideas book going. So I used to say to the team, in the end, we had a sports team of about a dozen down there, I think, something like that, which is incredible for independent radio. And I'd say, come in with a book and have 10 ideas each day. We'll have a meeting. Each of you's got to have 10 ideas. So you're talking about 120 ideas. And my brother-in-law started working there when he was 16 on his work experience from school anyway. And I think he just turned 17. And he came in one day, and my brother-in-law, don't forget, and he's come in. I said, where's your workbook, John? And he said, I've forgotten it. I said, you're no bloody use to me. Go on, home. Anyway, his mum's phoned me up and gone, what's the matter with John? He's at home, he's in tears. I said, can't be one rule for one and one rule for another. Richard Park in me. What a dreadful thought.
And on that bombshell, I think we will wrap it up. But just quickly, what you're doing this weekend? What games are you covering? You've normally got a myriad to do, both of you. Derek, what about you?
I've got a game from La Liga, Almeria, Atletico, and then I head to Germany next week for 6 games in 7 days to kick off the second half of the Bundesliga season. They've been on a longer break than most other leagues.
Wow, yeah, wow. They've had a rest, wow. Haven't they? Goodness me.
Proper I'm doing break. Brighton, Liverpool, and then I'm doing PSG away at Rennes, I think it is, on Sunday night on BT.
You see, variety is the spice of life, folks, particularly with these two guys. JP, Derek, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to kickstart the series with you two guys at the centre of it. So thank you for coming on.
Pleasure. Lovely.
Thanks for having us, Dance.
So my thanks to Jonathan Pearce and Derek Ray for joining me on this first edition of the new series, The Commentator's Curse. I hope you enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, you can delve into the archive of all the previous episodes of The Commentator's Curse. And of course, I'd always appreciate a rate, review, and subscribe if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, if you do enjoy what you've heard. Be back very shortly with another episode of The Commentator's Curse. I'm Ian Dancer signing off. Hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll speak to you next time.